All right, in the absence of anyone who volunteered, I decided I'll give a talk on some stuff we did some time ago, which is not directly relevant to dwarf galaxies and reionization, but I think has some interesting tangents for stuff that we've been discussing. This work largely done in collaboration with Aaron Dutton, who did most of the hard work, and it's about trying to see what constraints we can get on the combination of basically how halos respond to baryons, AC, aka antibody contraction, and the stellar IMF by using empirical relations on the scaling relations of galaxies. So it's a very empirically motivated way of doing this. So there's two scaling relations for early types and for late types. For late types, we have the Tully-Fisher relation, which says that the luminosity goes as rotation velocity to some power. The exact value of the power depends a little bit on the photometric band, but you know, in the sort of K bandish regime, R band is of the order of 3.5. Okay? Interesting part of the Tully-Fisher relation, non-trivial, is that the scatter in this Tully-Fisher relation is not correlated with size. Okay? That's very different from the equivalent scaling relation for ellipticals, which is called the Faber-Jackson relation. It says again that luminosity scales this time with the velocity of dispersion to some power, and that power is similar to 3.5, it's the order of 4-ish. Okay? But now it turns out that the scatter in this relation is directly correlated with size. Okay? And that's why normally we go and do a three-parameter relation and call it the fundamental plane. Okay? So this is just a projection of the fundamental plane relation. So that's an interesting difference, and you can learn something about galaxy formation from that. The slopes and the zero points are also interesting for galaxy formation. Of course, these scaling relations, additionally, can also be used to, as distance indicators, but that's not the topic of today. So what is the origin of these relations? I mean, in its simplest form, okay, we believe that they have something to do with the fact that all dark matter halos basically have roughly the same density profile, in particular that they will always have the same density. Okay, the average density of a halo is always about 200 times the average density. Okay? And that's the same for all halos independent of mass. And that basically means that the virial velocity is proportional to the virial radius, and both of these are proportional to the virial mass of 1/3. Okay? Now if you take into account that what we're measuring are not dynamics at the virial radius, okay. So a more obvious thing to use to describe the dark matter halo is the maximum circular velocity of a halo. Okay, if you take an NFW profile, then you have to take into account the fact that dark matter halos have a concentration, and the concentration does scale with halo mass, and that breaks at 1/3 power. But basically what you find from simulations, you take these concentration mass relations into account, that the maximum circular velocity of a halo scales with the virial mass of a halo to the 0.29. Okay? Now, here comes the fantastic result. You go with the observations, and you measure, for example, the circular velocity of a disk galaxy at 2.2 disk scale lengths. That's what observers like to do. And it's proportional to stellar mass to the 0.28. Okay? You go to elliptical galaxies, you measure the velocity dispersion inside the effective radius, and it's proportional to stellar mass to the 0.29. So voila, we're done. Okay? That's it. We understand the origin of these relations. Well, you know, the fact that the agreement is so good might urge you in that direction, but there's much more to it. If you want to explain it as just due to that, there's two requirements. First of all, you need to have that the actual measured velocity, okay, which I call V optical here, divided by this V max, which is a property of the halo, is a constant. Okay? V opt is V2.2 in the case of my disk galaxies, and it's basically the velocity dispersion within the effective radius for my early type galaxies. Okay? And it's not at all obvious that that ratio to the circular velocity at the maximum from a dark matter halo should be constant. The second requirement is that the stellar mass to the halo mass basically need to be constant. If both of these criteria are correct, then we have understood the origin of the scaling relations. But I'll argue that neither of these is even remotely correct. And the reason is, this relation, the stellar mass to halo mass relation, is something that's set by galaxy formation. And we all know that galaxy formation efficiency is not independent of halo mass. Okay? We know that this relation goes down towards dwarfs. Okay? At low mass halos become very inefficient. Okay, and there seems to be a peak at about 10 to the 12, and then it becomes less efficient again, maybe. Okay. When you change this ratio of the stellar mass contribution to the halo mass contribution, yes?
Shouldn't it be baryon mass, not stellar mass, if related to real mass is constant?
Well, how do you know? You missed the part where I explained where this comes in. Because what I was talking about was that you try to explain the fundamental scaling relations. For the halos, you have this relation. And the observed relation is basically the same, with the same slope. So if you want to understand the stellar scaling relations, okay, as just being due to this, and you want that m star over m vir is constant. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but the ratio of optical to Vmax will depend on baryon mass, not on stellar mass, right?
Going there. That's correct. What I'm saying is, if you want to explain it, the fundamental fairness scaling relations are just coming from this relation, then these two things have to be constant, and I'm going to argue they're not, for various reasons. First of all, this thing is not expected to be constant. If I now change this, the stellar mass to halo mass contribution, that's going to change this ratio, the optical ratio, to the maximum, because of the contribution of the stars to the rotation curve. They have self-gravity, they contribute to the rotation curve. In addition, if I change the amount of baryons in my halo is likely going to respond, to contract, and that can further boost this ratio V up to V max H. Okay?
Well, but when stellar mass goes down, if baryon fraction is constant, gas fraction goes up, right? So you can have constant V up to V max for non-constant.
You can tune these things to this thing, take constant while I change that by changing gas mass fractions. All I'm saying is, from the point of galaxy formation, there's no reason at all to expect that either of those should be constant. They're likely to vary. So that leaves the question of how then do we understand the origin of scaling relations. That means we need to understand how this thing scales with halo mass, how this thing scales. Okay. So let's look at this dark halo response, or adiabatic contraction. Okay? Probably you're familiar with this. The idea is that you have baryons, they contract at the center by cooling processes, and they contract in the dark matter halo. And the way that people normally incorporate this in their modeling is in a very simple form. Okay, it goes back to a paper by Blumenthal et al. You basically make a number of assumptions. You say in the limit where the process is slow, the response of the halo will be adiabatic. That's perfectly correct. Now, how does this then work out? Well, you make the assumption of spherical symmetry. Okay, and under spherical symmetry, what you have is that adiabatic invariant is R times the mass within R. That's the adiabatic invariant. So under the process of this gas cooling out to the center, this thing should be conserved. You then make the assumption that there's no shell crossing. Okay? When the dark matter halo contracts, the order of the shells of dark matter is preserved, and that basically means that the mass that's initially within the halo mass that's initially within the radius Ri is the same as the halo mass that is now inside the radius RF, or RF is the contracted shell, okay? Because you don't mix the shells. And finally, you assume that initially you start out in an initial state that's well mixed. It means that the baryons that end up in the center initially are assumed to have basically the same profile as the dark matter. Okay? You don't have to make that assumption, but that's the way that people normally do it. Under those three assumptions, you can solve for the ratio of the final radius of a shell of mass to the initial radius of a shell of mass. That's just given by this equation, okay? And what goes in here is the initial profile of the halo, both here and here, because of that constraint, okay? The baryon fraction that cools out, okay? And the profile of those baryons, okay? So if you know what the halo initially looks like, and you make an assumption of what the baryons finally in the halo here look like, you can work out how the halo contracts, how a radius of Ri contracts to become a radius of Rf. And that's how people normally incorporate it in their semi-analytical models. The problem is that, you know, the system is not spherical, the process of galaxy formation is probably not entirely adiabatic, okay? There's a lot of stuff going on. So what we're going to do is we're going to write this in a much more general way. We're going to write that this ratio is this factor gamma to some power nu, okay? And that nu is just completely free parameter, okay? And that just means that for nu is 1, I have standard adiabatic contraction. For nu is 0, it basically means I have no adiabatic contraction. And if I said nu less than 0, it basically means that I have expansion, okay? It may come about with supernova winds or whatever, okay? So I'm just going to see what data can tell me about this value of nu, okay? Don't try to understand it physically at the moment. I'm just trying to see empirically what are the constraints. Just for reference, if you look at hydrodynamical simulations of galaxy formation by Nick Gnaden, Oleg Gnaden, He basically has looked into this in more detail and more realistic. I'm not making these assumptions. He basically suggests that the best fit value should be nu of about 0.8.
Sorry, where's the nu coming from again?
Nu is just a simple parameterization. I just don't want to use adiabatic contraction exactly as in this way, but I want to include
something as a function.
It's just this with respect to the standard adiabatic contraction sort of way to think about it, right? So one of these, you exactly assume adiabatic contraction in the standard way.
So it is a power in that.
It's a power, yeah. Okay. Sorry, yes.
But the simulation does give you RF over RI.
Sorry?
The simulation does give you RF over RI, so you can check whether
So that's what Olin did. His simulation gave this, and then he compared it to this. So and he found basically if you do 0.8, then basically that matches the simulation.
But it's more than just a parameterization. You can actually check whether the simulation does that.
Yes. But the question is whether the real universe does it. Right? So we're going to see that the real universe isn't like this at all.
We can argue with the real one.
After I'm done. All right, so structural models. Okay, so I'm going to make a very simple model for galaxies. It consists of three components, a dark matter halo. Okay, the halo is modeled as a circle and a W profile. Concentration mass relation is the standard. Okay, and all of this is completely specified by its mass. So once I assume a halo mass, I know what the profile is. For the stellar component, I'm going to assume that I can model this as a sum of two surcic profiles, okay? One with n equal 1, it's an exponential, and one with the vocal Hertz profile. And when talking about late-type galaxies, I always assume that the n equal 1 profile is a disk, and n equal 4 is the bulge, okay? That makes sense. In the case of early types, none of them have any particular meaning. It's just that it turns out that if you fit a profile with two surcics, you always get a better fit than with one surcic. So it's just a way of, you know, I'm going to fit real profiles of galaxies with a sum of two surcic profiles, and that always gets a better fit than with one, obviously. Okay. They don't really have a meaning. But in the case of late types, these two components obviously have a logical link to the disk and bulge. Okay. So this basically is specified by four parameters. Disk mass and disk radius, bulge mass, I call this bulge. I always will call the n equal 4 component the bulge, and the other one the disk. But that's just naming convention. Okay? So MB and RB. Okay? And the total stellar mass is just the sum of these two. And then finally, we have a cold gas component, which we assume to be a thin exponential disk, which is specified by two components, gas mass and gas radius. Okay? So that's 4, 5, 6, 7 parameters specify my model.
So it's a thin disk even in the early type?
In the gas?
Yeah.
In the early types of disk have zero gas.
Okay.
Because dynamically it's not important. All that matters here is the dynamical influence in terms of how it contributes to a dynamical mass measure. So, and then this is the data that we're going to use to constrain these models. And I'll show you in a minute what we're going to do how those work. So this is basically the Kelly-Fisher relation, okay? Stellar mass here, function of V2.2. This is the compilation of different data sets. Authors are listed here. And this is basically the relation that goes as V2.2 to M star to the 0.28 that I showed you earlier. Okay, so here it is. It's a nice constraint. Here is, without the actual data points, just the best fit relation. For the basically the Faber-Jackson relation, velocity dispersion of ellipticals versus stellar mass. This is our own determination from Sloan data in red. The dashed line is the determination by Galazzi et al. From the same Sloan data, and Haidt and Bernardi et al., who use a slightly different measure for velocity dispersion inside 1/8 of the effective radius. And that explains why they have a little bit of an offset. But overall, all these relations agree. So the main upshot is, observationally, these relations are pretty nicely determined. We really know what they look like. So here's now the methodology that I'm going to do. I'll walk you through this. So the idea is we're going to start with data. Okay? It's a very empirically motivated result. So the data is always taken from Sloan. What we get from Sloan is, first of all, a relation, I'll tell you how we get that later on, between halo mass and stellar mass. Okay? So we have that relation. Okay? And when we have relations between stellar mass of a disk and the scale length of the disk, we have relations with stellar mass and the bulge size, we have relations between stellar mass and gas mass. All these, I'm going to show you these data, okay? So these are all empirical relations. They're all taken from the same data set. So basically the upshot is, once I pick a halo mass, I can use all these observed empirical relations to determine all the other six parameters, the disk mass, the bulge mass, the gas mass, and the radii. Okay? That all comes from observations. It's not a model anymore. The only thing that I do is I choose a halo mass, and then all this other stuff follows. And then I need to make two assumptions.
I guess you're going to explain where the halo mass comes from.
Yeah. So once I know all these mass components, I can work out a circular velocity curve, okay? Which is just the quadratic sum of all the contributions from halo, disk, bulge, and gas. Okay? For the halo, I need to do this adiabatic contraction. Okay? So there is a model how I do that adiabatic contraction. That's a new parameter. Okay? But that's one model parameter. And the other thing is that all these relations here come from Sloan data. So they start out with optical data in different photometric bands, and then they have inferred somehow in stellar mass. And when doing that, they assumed an IMF. Now, if I would choose a different IMF, all these scaling relations would be different. Okay? So all these scaling relations, therefore all these results depend on what I assume for the IMF. So my IMF is also a free parameter. So I have an IMF and I have adiabatic contraction. Those are the only two free parameters. Okay? For the choice of those two parameters for a given MH, I know the rotation curve. Okay? That I can turn into V2.2. I can now measure what is the circuit velocity at 2.2 disk scale lengths. And I can also measure the effective velocity dispersion in the case of an elliptical. Okay, and for that, all I need to know is the relation between what is the circular velocity at the effective radius divided by the velocity dispersion at the effective radius. And for that, we're going to use galaxy lensing data. Okay, strong lensing data has given us some good constraints on this. So I put that in here. Okay, so again, that's an empirical relation. Well, almost empirical. So what you're going to do is you sample many different halo masses. It gives you a sample of many different galaxies, for which I now know the V2.2, and I know the stellar mass. I can then basically predict what the Fisher and fundamental plane or Faber-Jackson relations are. I compare that to the data, and I run this through and constraining these two parameters. Okay?
It seems to me it's better on the star formation history, not just on the time.
Where does the star formation history come in?
Know how old the stars are.
I don't need to know that.
Because
I use stellar masses, right? So that dependence has gone into converting.
I thought that's how you got the stellar mass.
That comes from Sloan data, and so that we basically use the stellar masses determined by the Kaufman, Johns Hopkins group, the MPA, Johns Hopkins group. So they do this FCD fitting. So there's uncertainties there, but that uncertainty, basically, the way to think about it is just think of it as sort of hidden in that parameter, right? I assume that it's a systematic uncertainty, and that systematic uncertainty, this is sort of a systematic, I'll show you exactly how this parameter is defined. It's basically a systematic offset in my stellar masses, okay? And in the absence of systematic uncertainties, it's just pure IMF parameter. Okay, so is this scheme clear?
And do you have no scatter in the scaling relation?
No, we're going to ignore scatter, but we have errors on the mean relations of all these scaling relations, and we propagate all these errors. Okay. So I'll show you now what all these data sets look like. So what we did is we went to Sloan, and Luc Simard used his GIM2D photometric software to analyze 270,000 galaxies, for which he fits basically a sum of two Cirsic profiles. Okay. And this is sort of the, for assumption of stellar mass for the early types and the late type galaxies, what is the fraction of the n equal 4 component divided by the fraction of the n equal 1 component. So for this galaxy, it's always completely dominated by the n equal 1 component. It's a little bit, you know, the Bose component becomes a little bit more important at the massive end. For ellipticals, you know, whatever this thing tells you, you don't interpret this too much, but it just means that it's not perfectly fit by the Vaucouleurs profile, and at the low mass end is better fit by a pure exponential, and here it's better fit by a very exponential with a very large n, but that's nicely represented by a combination of two different Cirsic profiles, one with NS4 and one with NS1. So this does not mean much, but from that fit we also get then the sizes, okay? What I'm calling here is R50, so that's the radius enclosing 50% of the Bayesian flux, as function of stellar mass. For the disk and the bulge component, okay, here we can even call them disk and bulge component. And then the total light distribution is given by the black line. So you see that basically traces the disk, okay, because most of the light is dominated by the disk. It's obvious here. For comparison, here's a result from Shen et al., 2003, who measured the sizes of galaxies in Sloan. You see that our result is significantly offset. That's due to the fact that they use a circular aperture. okay? Whereas we actually have in our M2D fitting, inclination is included, and we do not use circular aperture. And that gives a systematic error, okay? So we think our results are a little bit better. And then here's the same thing for early types. We're now N equal 1 and N equal 4, whatever it means. The main thing is the black line, which is the average effectiveness radius of an elliptical as function of stellar mass. And it is in excellent agreement with the results from Chamberlain, okay? So we use this black relation in both cases to turn our, okay, we use these relations between the red and the blue curves, okay, to turn any stellar mass of a galaxy, and then we know what is the contribution of the two components. Of each component, we know what the size is. Okay, so that's what we do. Now, of course, all these relations here, these stellar masses, come from Sloan photometry, okay, and they've been obtained by this group, assuming a Charpentier IMF. Now, if they would have used a different IMF, all these stellar masses would change left and right. Okay? And basically the effect is of changing the IMF is just of adding to log M star, adding some value. Okay? So obviously for the Charpentier IMF, delta IMF is zero. But if I wanted to go to a Salpeter IMF, all I have to do is change all these stellar masses in the log by 0.24 dex. And then basically I have the equivalent of having used a Salpeter IMF. Okay? So that's how this parameter, which is just shifting all the stellar masses up or down, is equivalent to changing the IMF. Here are some other relations. This is the gas mass fractions. We've used a suite of different data samples. You see it's pretty nicely determined. It's going for late-type galaxies. We've heard earlier in the week several times that, you know, you go to lower stellar mass systems, the gas fraction gets higher. It's not really the gas fraction, it's the gas to star ratio. Okay? They're completely dominated by gas at the low mass end. This is the radius of the H1 divided by the radius of the R-band flux. As function of stellar mass, okay, has quite a bit of scatter, but again, on average, we just use this relation. This is sort of the 68% confidence range around this, and we propagate these errors always through, okay? So all these bands that you see around it, that's sort of the uncertainty on these empirical relations that we propagate through. But you'll see they're all dominated by one error, and that's the error in the halo mass, the stellar mass relation. That's the dominant error, so none of this really matters. Okay, this is to show you where the empirical relations come from. Here is this discussion, okay, we needed to be able to convert the circular velocity at the effective radius, because that's what I compute from my model. I need to be able to turn it into a velocity dispersion within the effective radius, because that's what the observers measures. And for that we use a value of 1.54, and that comes from basically the SLEX survey of strong gravitational lensing. They've done some decent modeling, okay, and what they're plotting here for all their lens galaxies, look at the open symbols, which are basically the velocity dispersion within the effective radius, and they compare that to the velocity of a single isothermal ellipsoid, I think this is, SIE, is that a single isothermal? Yeah, okay, so basically, the average is about 1.54. This is square root of 3, this is square root of 2, so some obvious values that people have used in the past. We can compare this value from the SLEX survey to some other studies. Kilpatmanabhan a few years ago, looking at LRGs, found that the ratio was 1.65, a little bit larger. Capellari et al. Used 1.44 based on studies from Sauron. So there's quite a bit of scatter in this thing, so what we do is we add a 0.03 dex uncertainty that basically around this thing, so that basically this one and this value both lie within the 68% confidence interval. Okay? So again, that error is propagated. So then the final thing is how do we get the halo mass, the stellar mass relation? And for that we use satellite kinematics. Okay? So the idea is very simple. Satellite galaxies are traces of the dynamics of the halo via the simple Virial equation. Velocity dispersion is gm over r, okay, but it's in the halo mass and halo radius. We know that halos obey this proportionality. It's another way of saying all halos have roughly the same density. You plug that in here, basically what you find is that the velocity dispersion of the satellites should scale as halo mass to 1/3. Okay, and that's how you can measure the velocity dispersion of satellites in a halo. You have basically a good measure of the mass of the halo.
Is that the line of sight?
That's the 3D, but there are some. Basically, you don't even have to make any assumption about isotropy because as long as in 1D, as long as you measure it over the entire system, you're insensitive to anisotropy because that's just governed by this equation. It's just total kinetic energy. How you distribute it over isotropy is irrelevant. But observation where you measure is the 1D velocity dispersion. Now, the problem, of course, is how do you do this on an individual galaxy, okay? Suppose you would put a Milky Way out of the typical Sloan distance, what we're going to see is an LMC and SMC, so one or two satellites. From that, you get a very, very, very lousy velocity dispersion. So what you have to do is you have to stack, okay? So you go to the Sloan, you identify all these central galaxies, okay? You stack all central galaxies of the same luminosity together, and you look at all their satellites, okay? And then you get a measure for the velocity dispersion. So what you do is, you go to Sloan, you select centrals and satellites, okay, and there's slightly different ways of doing that. You can test your robustness of that machinery with MOCs, that's what we have done in great detail. And what you basically then do is you use the redshift to measure the velocity difference between the satellite and the central, and you do that as a function of the stellar mass of the central. So this is now stellar mass, but this is luminosity, okay. This is basically real data, so this is the luminosity in the R band, I think, from Sloan versus the delta V. And what you see by eye, now the velocity dispersion grows if you go to more massive galaxies. That already tells you, okay, these guys live in more massive halos. Duh. Okay. This is interlopers, okay, which, you know, you have to be careful. But the nice thing about interlopers is that the first order, their velocity distribution is perfectly flat. Okay, so you can nicely subtract it. Okay. So what you're going to do now is you're going to take a little bin, okay, and you plot the distribution of these delta Vs. Okay. And at the wings, they go to a constant that's non-zero. That's just your interloper conservation, so you can subtract that off. And then you measure this velocity dispersion. Okay. Now comes a tricky question. This is what people have done in the past, and then they just take velocity dispersion and they use that relation basically and bum, they're done. Now, it's not as trivial as that. And the reason is they have to be very careful because of that stacking. What you really have done is, you have to realize that galaxies of the same stellar mass may live in halos of different masses. There is going to be scatter in that relation. Plus the fact that you've used a finite bin width of stellar masses, and that also has added, therefore, scatter in the halo mass. So you have to think carefully what you have measured. And what most people have measured is what I would call the satellite-weighted velocity dispersion. Okay? So what they do is each central satellite pair in their stack gets the same weight. Okay, so each satellite effectively has gotten a weight of one. What you have then done in principle is this thing. Okay? What they have done is they have integrated over all halo masses that host the central galaxy with that stellar mass. Okay? So I need to know what is this probability distribution function. Different halo masses add different numbers of satellites on average. Okay? If I have in my stack two halos and one has twice the mass of the other one, most likely that one will also contribute twice as many satellites. And therefore, that more massive halos is weighted twice as heavy as a lower mass halo. Okay, so that will skew my measure if I don't take that into account. And also I need to take into account that different halo masses add different velocity dispersions. Okay, this just skews with that halo to the two-thirds in this case. Okay? So this thing is that I can determine quite well from genes modeling. I sort of know what this should look like from an NOW profile. Okay, as I said, it doesn't really depend on anisotropy. So this is really well known. But this one I don't know. And the goal is to obtain this one because this is basically describing my relation between halo mass and stellar mass. So that's what we're after. Okay? And what people have done in the past is assume that this has zero scatter. And if it has zero scatter, then this is a Dirac delta function, and this satellite-weighted velocity dispersion is exactly the same as another measure, which is what I call the host-weighted velocity dispersion. What you do there is now you give each satellite a weight that is one over the number of satellites around that central. Okay, so if you have two systems, one with one satellite and one with two, then one with two satellites, each delta V pair you give a weight of a half. That way both systems have a weight of one for the per central. Did I explain it correctly or was it confused?
Just wondering about tucking the dispersion if you have one.
So it's very simple. So for each individual system, you know, central satellites, you know how many satellites are around that central. Each of that central satellite pair now gets a weight of one over the number of satellites. That way, you're weighting hosts equally. And what you're effectively doing is just the same thing, except this NS doesn't pop in there anymore. And now the cool thing is that if indeed you convince yourself that if this is a Dirac delta function, that those two are going to be exactly the same. But in reality, you can measure both of them, and you'll find they're not the same. But this is great, because this allows you actually to measure not only the mean of this thing, but also the scatter. Okay? Because it's only in the limit where this thing has scatter that these two are different. Okay? And the more scatter I have in the relation, the larger the ratio of these two things will be. So I can use this ratio between these two measures to get the scatter. And that will break my degeneracy, because typically you have a degeneracy between scatter in this relation and the mean of that relation. Okay? And then, of course, the satellites per host, you also have to model that. Basically, you know, the same stuff goes in there. You have to sort of know how many satellites per halo and what is this relation. So all of this, what you do is you basically make, you know what this thing is. So you make a model for this relation, okay? And you make a model for this. You simultaneously solve over everything using data. So here's the data. This is this host-weighted velocity dispersion as function of stellar mass. The satellite-weighted velocity dispersion of stellar mass. If you can look carefully, you can see that, for example, the mass event, they're not the same. This one is higher. Okay? That's an indication that there is scatter in that relation. This is the observed average number of satellites around the host of that mass. Okay, we use a volume-limited sample here. Okay. So then we run this through our machinery, okay, Monte Carlo, Markov chains, to sort of constrain this relation between halo mass and stellar mass. And here's the result. This is now a function of stellar mass, the mean halo mass, okay, for early types and for late types. You see it's not perfectly the same. Okay. So you see that at a given stellar mass, early type galaxies leave more massive halos than late type galaxies. But it's very weak, except there's an interesting trend here that there are only very few galaxies that are this massive at the early time, at the late type end. Anyway, you can turn this around now and plot, put it in some more cosmologically interesting numbers. This is the stellar mass divided by the kind of halo mass, M200, divided by the baryon fraction. Okay? So one would mean all the baryons have turned into stars. Okay, it's a function of stellar mass for late types and for early types. Okay, so our Milky Way, a few times 10 to 10, lives somewhere here, about 20%. Okay, but with quite a bit of uncertainty. This is the uncertainty on the mean that we have to propagate through. Okay, and this uncertainty just comes from the fact that these error bars are, you know, as large as they are. And this is based on, you know, Sloan. It's not going to get any better in the next coming years. Okay, so this is about as good as it's going to be for the next couple of years, based on satellite kinematics. There are other methods to do this. Okay, early time. So this is the relation that we use. Okay, we use this mean relation and the scatter around it, propagate that through.
So how does this relation compare to abundance matching?
Really well. So in this
respect, we're just about to ask that. So if you look at G Quad, she's everywhere above your blue line.
Who?
G Quad.
Ju.
Oh,
Chi. Whoa. Chi. I don't know that one. I know that Peter Baruzzi, Peter Baruzzi did a study of this, and he plotted all these things on top of each other, and that was a good agreement. It's really nasty to make sure that everyone uses exactly the same stellar masses and all that stuff again. And
is 200 critical or 200?
It's 200. This is, I don't know what this one is. I think this is 200 over density. So you need to do that.
So we looked at that with Chi for quite a while. That's why I asked. She said, no, I'm right, and he's wrong.
Well, okay. So
that's what everyone said. So that's the thing that you plot the same.
But how did they get that relation?
Exactly.
Abundance match.
Yes.
This is dynamic of masses, right? I mean, I totally agree, and we've seen similar issues. And you know, you can use clustering, you can use galaxy lensing. We have seen some, you know, disagreement between these results and, for example, the results from Mandelbaum et al. But it was based on the analysis of Mandelbaum et al. We've now done a new analysis with lensing, and that's in better agreement with these satellite kinematics. So you know, I think overall within this error bar, I don't really believe that your signal in blue is off.
Is this error bar or scatter?
This is the error bar on the mean.
Okay.
So the satellite kinematics don't give you very tight constraints. Okay? If you do clustering or abundance matching, your constraints are much, much, much tighter. Okay? This is the error, the one sigma, or maybe this is two sigma, I can't remember. I could look at the paper. It's the error on the mean, not the scatter.
But you computed the scatter.
We have computed the scatter. The scatter, basically, what we find is that the scatter in halo mass at fixed stellar mass for central galaxies is 0.15 dex, and we find basically it's consistent with that being independent of halo mass.
So that's much bigger or much smaller?
0.15 dex, that's, well, and this is, both of them have stellar mass, and it becomes a bit tricky.
And you can't go much lower stellar mass because of the lack of satellites and
yes,
Sloan?
Yes. So unfortunately, you can't go lower. But I think it gets very interesting to see whether that scatter goes up when you go to lower mass, which sort of seems to be what's needed. We were talking about that earlier. But within this mass range, there's no indication that the scatter in halo mass affects telemass is dependent on halo mass. But the scatter in halo mass, no, hold on, am I saying it right now? No, I'm saying it wrong. At a fixed stellar mass, the scatter in halo mass is 0.15 dex. No, I'm saying wrong again.
So at fixed halo mass, the scatter in stellar mass of central galaxy is 0.15 dex.
But the scatter in halo mass of fixed stellar mass is strongly strong function of stellar mass, and that comes from the relation, figure that stellar mass halo mass relation is so crooked. All right, this summarizes all these empirical relations that now go into that modeling software. So let's see what we get out. So the first thing we do is we assume gnadin adiabatic contraction. For a given stellar mass, I now know what my halo mass is from that relation. And here I'm not plotting any errors, here I'm just plotting the averages. But this is an interesting sort of first go at it. It's plotting as function of stellar mass, what is the barrier mass fraction within 2.2 disk scale lengths for late types and within the effective radius for early types. If I assume a Saint-Peter IMF, Charbonnier IMF, I get this relation. Okay? So within 2.2 disk scale lengths goes up to about 0.7. Like 70% of the mass inside that radius is barren. If I would assume a Saint-Peter IMF, I get this relation. Okay? So now I'm going above 1.
Sorry, so this is the fraction of the total mass that is baryon.
Fraction of the dynamical total mass within 2.2.
Okay, so not disk. Relative to like a megabaryon.
No.
Okay.
So this is within 2.2 disk scale.
Okay.
Okay. So this is just sort of, you know. And this is sort of indicating already that you could put the constraints on the IMF. Okay. For this particular model of the adiabatic contraction, we'll see that in more detail. Okay. So Peter sort of ruled out.
That doesn't take into account that the stellar masses he got to begin with didn't assume Salpeter.
No, they did. So when I changed IMF, all these empirical relations changed, and then I run the software again, and then I get the same thing. So all that changed.
All the way from all the different color bands of the Sloan to get the stellar mass using a different machine.
No, I know for a given galaxy what is its stellar mass, given Charbonnier IMF. Now I say I'm playing with this delta IMF. So I say Saint-Peter corresponds to giving all stellar masses an increase in stellar mass of 0.27 dex. So that's what I do. And I have a new set of empirical relations now, and they run through.
How sensitive is that to your upper and lower stellar mass migration limits? Star mass.
I'll show you in a minute. This is just the first go to sort of get some
feeling. So what's your default range?
Default range of what?
Stellar masses.
Masses of stars.
Masses of stars over which you're calculating the IMF.
Oh, point 0.1 to 100?
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's 0.1 to 100, not 0.08 to 100.
Okay. For both IMFs?
Yeah.
In this plot, you've got the forbidden regions, and you say you Saint-Peter's and like
so,
this.
So basically, the upshot is late-type galaxies 10 to the 11 solar masses cannot have a Charbonnier IMF. They cannot have a Saint-Peter IMF.
So I guess the question I was going to ask, there's obviously a whole lot of errors to be propagated through, and those are small enough that there's still a lot of rule down.
Coming. So this is the first shot. It'll give you a flavor of how you can put constraints on these different things. So the same thing at early types, you know, you basically start to rule out Saint-Peter IMF as this intermediate mass range. Saint-Peter IMF is still allowed, interestingly, in the very massive end. We'll see that that's interesting at the end.
There's similar constraints from maximum disk, right?
Yes. So this is not the first time we point this out.
The first time, you're just saying you can actually get it from smaller masses, so much smaller radii, just directly so that you can't exceed the rotation curve.
Yes.
I think that excludes Saint-Peter as well, right?
Yes. Okay, so here comes another real thing, because after all, we were going to see if we could explain the scaling relation. So you observed scaling relation, fundamental, Tully Fisher relation is indicated in this hatched area. So now what we do is we assume gnadin in the low adiabatic contraction, which means we set this new parameter 0.8. We assume Charbonnier IMF, we run this entire thing, and we predict this Tully Fisher relation, this solid line. Okay? And it's
quite off. And this is sort of that scatter net related, that plus or minus 0.25 is sort of that band that I showed you in that relation between stellar mass and halo mass. If I propagate that through, that's sort of what it does. Okay? So there's no way that I can call this consistent. And this is well known, okay? Fitting the zero point of the Tully-Fisher relation has been a very well-known issue in galaxy formation. And the way people sort of go about it is sort of either sort of completely ignoring all this and just say, ah, well, the rotation curve of disk is just V-ver, or sometimes they use Vmax, okay? But here we have added the self-gravity of the disk and we have added adiabatic contraction, and that boosts the velocity, okay, of the disk galaxy. And therefore, at a given stellar mass, they're rotating too fast. It's a very well-known problem. Okay. And
what about the shape, if you look at
those at all? The rotation curves? No. We haven't looked at that. I mean, these are the sort of Dutton models, so we know that they look really good. They look like flat rotation curves.
Right. But I mean,
they don't look like falling things, like some of the simulation results do.
Not anymore.
I know. Not anymore.
So you explained the difference between Vmax and V-virial. Vmax and V-optical, that...
So the standard, this under this approach, you have that V-optical to Vmax about, I know Vmax to V-vir is 1.8. So Vmax to V-vir is 1.2, so 1.8 divided by 1.2.
But Vmax to V-optical is always the same? I wouldn't expect Vmax to V-optical to be the same for all types of galaxies.
Empirically,
yeah. If
this ratio Vmax to V-optical is close to 1, that's what you need to get this consistent. Okay? I agree with you, that's not what you expect. And what you expect is something that looks like this, and then you don't get it to work. So it depends on from what point you look at it. Okay? So there is a weak scaling. You expect a weak scaling, but it's fairly weak. So now, interestingly enough, that same model, same monolithic contraction, same IMF, is bang on top of the observed Faber-Jackson relation. So for early types, hooray, for late types, no. So what can we do? Well, we can play around. Let's take a look. So here's that solid line, it's the same one as before, okay? Gnadian related beta contraction, mu is 0.8. This is always setting the Chabrier IMF, okay? So delta IMF is 0. Now I play with that adiabatic, if I adopt the standard Blumenthal adiabatic contraction, you get this line, you make it even worse, okay? You have more adiabatic contraction. So you set adiabatic contraction to something advocated by another group of simulators, 0.6, it doesn't really help. You turn off adiabatic contraction, okay? You get close. Okay. This is the reason why in the 2007 paper, Aaron Dutton and I had the conclusion, you need to have no adiabatic contraction or even adiabatic expansion to explain the zero point of Tully-Fisher relation. And the same thing comes out here. Okay? Where now we've used empirical relations in all these relations, and the previous time we used a full sort of semi-analytical model.
What sort of simulations were the net-in simulations again?
Hydrodynamical. I don't know details.
I'm just wondering if there's a reason that the galaxies that live in those and what he calculated that from might be more early type than late type.
It's not very galaxy.
There's scattered adiabatic contraction that's found from galaxy to galaxy, but there's no obvious, nobody has identified what the scatter is due to yet. In the sense like it's not, some elliptical galaxies may have less or more contraction, but it's not clear what wide fluctuation exists. I have a question. So you have different simulation results, but there are also different observational measurements. So if I look at rays at all, their observational measurement of that relation is quite a bit higher than what this hatched narrow region is, and it's much closer to the simulation results. So what about that? I mean, is the fact that maybe the observations have some systematic error associated with it as well. I don't know.
I showed you that Tully-Fisher relation in the beginning, right, that we used, which combined three different data sets. I think the rays at all, some of you're talking about, they were just trying to measure V opt over V. They measured V opt over V disk using
plot
different.
Also this exact same plot, which is higher than what you showed here.
Well, maybe
they also conclude that the adiabatic contraction is okay. So from that the relations that you.
Mm-hmm. I remember that we discussed it, I can't recall what our conclusion was, but sure, if you're willing to argue that the beneficial relation that it is not correct, then
I'm just saying that there is a study that's an independent one which gives a beneficial relation difference systematically much larger than this size of the hatched region.
I'd have to look at that because I mean I'm most likely they use slightly different they measure the rotation flow curve at some different distance or something. What else could you know?
Most likely M star, which is different.
Or the stellar mass is different. But again, that's
sort of, which would you think?
So that's the other thing, right? If they use a different IMF, as we'll show you in the next geograph, it can also work, right? Because if I change my IMF, it can also move it up and down.
Where you should be.
No, I mean, if that's true, then I don't know the answer. I mean, I would have to look at it. So the same thing with early types, you know, you move, of course, in the same direction. So with early types, you would say no adiabatic attraction is ruled out because they sort of underpredict loss of dispersion. So here's sort of summary of all this together. And now we've played with both the IMF and the contraction. So this is sort of this delta log M star that we need. So this is basically this delta IMF thing. Okay? So a zero is Chabrier, so beta was plus 0.27. So this is the offset that we need to get a fit for the early types and for the late types. And this is for different contraction models. So this is Blumenthal et al, standard adiabatic contraction. This is Gnadin, so mu is 0.8. This is mu is 0.6. This is zero adiabatic contraction, so mu is zero. And this is some expansion model, where mu is negative. Okay? So basically we see is the Gnadin model, what we saw before, with the Chabrier IMF, and adiabatic contraction and Gnadin contraction works perfectly for the early types, but you're way off for the late types, meaning that you would need an IMF that is extremely top-heavy. Okay. If you don't want to accept that, you're going to say, no, you can't come up with an IMF that's so top-heavy. The most top-heavy that it can have is Chabrier Krupa, then you're sort of in this regime, you need either no adiabatic contraction or expansion.
And so that's because all of those lines were above, so
right.
For
right.
Fixed amount of light, you need yes. Less mass.
Yes. Yes, exactly. But I think the interesting part is that there's nowhere where these two curves combine. For early types and late types. So they have very different things. You cannot, either you assume universal IMF, in which case early type galaxies need to be more contracted than late types, which is not necessarily in the direction that people would have expected it. Yeah. Adiabatic contraction is more likely, it's by most people more associated with the formation of these galaxies. Okay. Or if you're willing to say, well, no, adiabatic contraction works always in the same way, then clearly early types and late types cannot have the same IMF. So that's basically the main upshot. You can start asking questions like, what could change the IMF? And then one particular model that I liked a lot, because the physics is so beautiful, is it goes back to Lars.
So what about this BC to sigma relation? How much would you need to change that to make them agree?
Oh, there's no way. That's well within these error bars. So these error bars propagate all these errors. And most of it comes just from the relation between halo mass and stellar mass. And that relation, that's a small contribution. We discussed it in the paper, but all of these error bars are completely dominated by that uncertainty stellar mass to halo mass.
Are they 95% confidence limits, or?
Typically, error in negative plots are typically plus 2 sigma, so I would bet on 2 sigma, but not too much money. An interesting idea was put forward by Larson in 98, where the idea was that this turnover in the IMF that you have with respect to saltpeter, okay, is related to the genes mass. And the genes mass is expected to increase with redshift due to the temperature of the CMB. Okay? So at higher redshifts, your genes mass is high, and therefore you have a more top-heavy IMF than at low redshift. Now, since early type galaxies have older stellar populations, they must have formed earlier, so they should have been, if that is the way it works, they should have had more top-heavy IMF. Well, if anything, The early types seem to have less top heavy ions.
Really,
it goes in the opposite direction.
You need to be beyond redshift 4 to this to have any effect whatsoever. So you must form all your stars beyond redshift 4. Because in nearby GMCs, the minimum temperature is about 10 Kelvin.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to go beyond redshift 3 to 4 to really get about that.
Mm-hmm.
And ellipticals seem to have most of the star formation around 3 to 4. So,
it's not surprising that it doesn't work.
That cannot work at all. Just even. Plus, the model, even though you think it's beautiful, I can tell you it's not related.
I know that you're first. So
on the assumption that it's not is not seen as in data simulations.
Mm-hmm. So is there, from your understanding of IMFs and what the real physics that governs it, is there an understanding of what could give rise to this?
Rise to what?
The fact that the IMF is more top-heavy than, well, either that or... Let me finish up first.
Sorry. Why do you think it's top-heavy?
Late types are more top-heavy than early types. That's the upshot.
I think top-heavy IMF in the Milky Way is excluded completely by chemical evolution. If you look at chemical evolution...
Well, Chabrier is called top-heavy with respect to Saint-Peter, whatever you... Right? So whatever you call top heavy.
Yeah, so any strong deviation from Chabrier excluded by chemical.
I agree. These IMFs are clearly ruled out. So that basically leaves for late types only basically that area where you have to have no independent contraction or expansion. Well, it's another way of saying maybe dark matter halos have cores around the cusp, which basically comes to the same thing.
But I try to understand the difference between the observational analysis first. Before you make
the
conclusion, right?
Okay, I'll work on that. I agree. But I'll be hard pushed to. I mean, this coefficient relation, as I showed you, it's based on three different data sets. Okay? If someone comes along and they didn't measure this data themselves, so did they use their own rotation curves or whatever?
They measured everything, Tally Fisher, Wickland. I mean, it's a Reyes, Redip, Tally Fisher, even Sloan, and then she worked with Mandelbaum to constrain ethereal masses.
Do they discuss why their Tally Fisher is way off from all the other previous determinations?
I think they do. I don't remember what they said. There's like Dutton et al. And their results.
Everything I'm going to say from now on, it's wrong if Reyes is correct. No, I mean, true. It's true.
It has to be understood before you can make. I think it would be tremendously interesting if this conclusion holds completely, but we need to understand whether it's there's systematic error in the data that can allow some movement, right?
Agree.
So isn't there, if you talk about top-heavy IMFs and you talk about older populations, isn't there a sort of degeneracy between either it's top-heavy and you have a lot of mass and remnants, or it's bottom-heavy, you have a lot of mass and small mass things which you don't see? I mean, do you for sure know it's one way or the other? Is it just it cannot be you have to have more mass?
So this parameter is not just a measure for turn off mass in the IMF. It's true that at some point when you push that other, it's not a monotonic relation, and that has to do with this remnant stuff, as far as I understood it. But I'm getting into an uncomfortable zone here. But that, as far as I understood it, that there's not a necessarily perfectly monotonic relation between this turn off mass and this parameter, and that has to do with when the remnants start contributing.
So another way that by looking at the plot that you could just get everything to work out using the Chabrier IMF is that if the early type and late types have a different type of adiabatic contraction.
Right.
So
right. But again, if I would have bet my money beforehand, I would have said, well, I don't care about that, but I would have expected that it's this galaxy's that are in the regime where adiabatic contraction operates, because they are low-entropy systems, thin disks, that probably have formed in an adiabatic fashion, whereas early types, oh, we think they have something to do with merging, smashing things again, that's very non-adiabatic, the merging process, dynamical friction, getting them together could cause the dark matter to be kicked out, so I would have expected the opposite behavior.
I was thinking differently because in terms of the orbits of the stars, and so I would imagine for elliptical you have more radial, typically more radial type of orbits, and for spirals more circular, and adiabatic contraction.
It's quite isotropic in the center, I think.
That's right, and even the distance between the radial, it's a small effect in terms of that new parameter.
The difference basically between the Blumenthal and Gnadin and the others is basically the orbits, whether they're radial.
So that's what I'm saying. Whether you have they assume certain orbits. Right. They actually show that that's not true. Of course, orbits are not radial, and then they get new 0.8. So what I'm saying is that issue about orbits is only makes only a small difference. We're talking about a difference between here mu zero or even negative. Whereas he and nu is 0.8. And that difference is 0.8 or more, cannot come from this difference in the orbit.
Because Gnadin assumed radial orbits?
They assumed whatever the simulation gave them, and then they showed that it's.
So they always measured in single way.
But then it's not totally radial. It's
not totally radial, but the elliptical galaxies don't have orbits that are totally radial either.
There's a small variation between the first and second. There is a just different ratio between circular and radial.
It would be interesting to chop up.
But again, it goes in the wrong direction. So if more radial pushes you in that direction, then the early time should be.
You also have significantly different gas fractions, gas system.
But that's taking into account, right?
It would be interesting to chop up the early type population, maybe looking at master slow rotators.
Very interesting. I have something to say at the very end. But that's a very good point. Okay. So then that's this point. I think there's a very interesting result that came out last year by Peter van Dokkum and Charlie Conroy, who started doing spectroscopy and looking at things I've never heard of, like the wing Ford band. Apparently there's some feature in spectra, in the infrared, in good infrared spectroscopy, where they're very sensitive to the contribution of M dwarfs, low mass stars. Almost no feature in your spectra is dominated by low-mass stars. Okay? If you look at an elliptical galaxy, all the absorption lines are dominated by the K-giant. Okay? So if you want to measure an IMF, you want to basically know what's the low-mass stars, so what's the contribution of low-mass stars. And it turns out that the wing four band and the sodium line feature are very sensitive, basically, to these low-mass stars. So they went through some very massive ellipticals, took a spectrum of their central region, did CAC, and here's the spectrum. Okay? And then they did some models for different IMFs to see which one fits best. And here's a blow-up of that interesting feature. So the group IMF is in blue. It runs here. And there's no way they could explain the depth of this feature. Saltpeter gets you in the right direction. But in fact, they needed to go and make something even less top-heavy than saltpeter. So they need to go to a slope of minus 3 or minus 3.5 here, which saltpeter is minus 2.35, okay, to explain this particular feature in the sodium region. The same thing in the wing Ford band, okay, they basically require this red model, minus 3.
But note that the two are inconsistent. The one that favors sort of something between...
Well, within the one single error bars, I mean, I wouldn't...
The purple from the wing Ford, it excludes purple, right?
Yes.
So I hope this paper that we had out, and there will be a paper coming out in a few weeks' time that shows this is completely wrong. I mean, this is we have observations of exactly this line in several lens systems, which are twice as deep as this one. If you want to fit that, and we're using their models, so we got their models. If you want to fit this, you have to change the sodium abundances dramatically. You have to make the IMF minus 3.5 to fit that particular system, and you overshoot the total. This is a lensing system. You overshoot the total mass by a factor of 3 within the Einstein radius.
I'm just putting it up as a very, okay.
There's a huge problem with the sodium line.
But are you looking at exactly the same? No, you're not looking at the same galaxy, but you're looking at
We're looking at several lens systems, one particular lens system which had a sodium line which is twice as deep as this on average. So if you draw their logical conclusions, it should have an exceedingly bottom-heavy IMF with a slope of minus 3.5 at least. But if you apply that model and take the luminosity of the galaxy, you have about 3 times as much stellar mass within the Einstein radius as total mass.
I think it's very interesting, but how do you explain this? Because they took data on globular clusters on M31. The reason why they picked those...
No, I mean, the observations are the observations. right? We're using them.
So you're saying the models are wrong.
The models are wrong.
The models are wrong.
The models for sodium lines can, well,
sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So we were looking at this a bit. We, with the new data set that Scott now has, Scott Traeger, he looked at a lot of stars with X-Shooter, and one of them came out with very strong sodium lines, and it's a giant. And so we looked a little bit into this, and it's difficult to make like really strong conclusions from it. But I think what happens is if you have a sodium enhanced star, which makes the sodium lines a bit bigger. I mean, as you say, all this light is generally dominated by giants. So you need a few giants with a weird abundance pattern to make this. And the interesting thing is that all the lines around this sodium feature are CN almost. So if you make something alpha enhanced, that means that you have more oxygen, for instance, and that the carbon will be locked in CO instead of CN. What you do then is you raise the continuum at the same time as you make the line deeper. And we haven't done like a full analysis of this, but my feeling is you would go, you know, it might explain at least partly this. And it goes in the right direction in the sense that we think that elliptical galaxies are alpha enhanced, at least.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, also apart from that point, we have access to other models, new synthetic models that try to do exactly the same feature. And surprisingly, I mean, this is unpublished. I mean, those models run exactly orthogonal to the models of this particular feature in
okay, so that's good news. That's
so, I mean, but you can just show based on just on the lensing that the IMF that this particular feature prefers is excluded. I mean, cannot.
So their IMF, right? It should lie just okay. But basically, if this IMF cannot exist in any low mass ellipticals, so they're actually getting data now on a bunch of ellipticals in this regime.
Talk about -3, -3.5.
What are they talking about for this point? Which?
So this is the inferred baryon fraction within an effective radius for their ellipticals.
No, but
for the average ellipticals, if all the ellipticals of this stellar mass have their IMF.
Which IMF? Right?
Which IMF is it?
The -3, I think.
So I think the data there essentially is consistent. So what the result is that they, I think the evidence that IMF is saltpeter, it's not Chabrier, it's solid. But anything beyond that is very questionable because the sodium line on which this is based seems suspect for various reasons.
Yeah.
But there is no such objections about the iron lines. And iron lines are consistent with saltpeter, but inconsistent with Chabrier.
Yeah,
and that's also consistent with the lensing analysis, which also indicates saltpeter.
So all these...
Here's the interesting thing about saltpeter, right? So I would argue saltpeter is really, really hard to reconcile with ellipticals in this mass regime. So if you look at, and this goes back to your question, if you look at these guys here, the really massive ones, they're all the standard boxy ellipticals, the giant ones. If you look at the disky ones, that dominate the numbers here. I mean, I would argue that it's going to be very tricky to reconcile that with Chabrier IMF.
If you look at the lensing and dynamical results, you see a continuous trend in, let's say, the fraction, which is, let's say, for a fixed, if you assume a fixed IMF, you see a continuous trend in what we call the dark matter fraction within an Einstein radius. But on one hand, we can show it's saltpeter for the massive ellipticals. On the other hand, Chabrier for the disky ones. But there's a continuous trend. So clearly that cannot be a case. If there's a dichotomy, you should see a shift. So there is sort of an increase in dark matter fraction as you go towards more massive systems. But at the same time, you also have a steepening of the IMF. And the question is, right, which one is contributing by what amount? But there seems to be a continuous trend from maybe saltpeter at massive end, 300, 350 kilometers per second, to sort of Chabrier in disk, but even in lenticulars, probably already have something between saltpeter and Chabrier.
Right, I agree.
That is, that bottom line, you just have a continuous trend towards a more shallow IMF.
So, can you go back to your plots with the IMFs? I'm just wondering how this whole thing is...
Yes?
Yeah, thanks. How this whole thing is affected by... So, locally, from Sloan, the observed mass function for below one solar mass is Gaussian, not a power law. So, how... I mean, clearly that, I mean, it doesn't have much of an effect on your delta log M starts. You're just accounting for low stellar mass. But same way, I know how that would affect, like, this result here if it was, if those low mass stars were being sampled differently.
You mean the actual IMF or the observed mass function of stars?
The inferred IMF, well, I mean, below one.
That's essentially Krupa. Krupa is
Krupa, and these things are close to. So.
Well, it's log normal if you plot normal IMF, not the way it's plotted. If you plot it in this way, it's like 2 power loss. But if you plot it in really.
Yeah, it's always this way. I always.
So it's just a confusion the way it's plotted, or?
Yeah, so Krupa here is essentially Chabrier. Yeah? There's very little difference between them. And that's what you're talking about.
Okay. I think that answers my question.
So basically, that's sort of all I had to say. I mean, and I think the upshot is, and I agree with what you're saying, that basically this trend of IMF changing, okay, and it's probably at the very massive end, you know, you have something called Peter, you go lower mass, you go to Chabrier, and by the time early late types, I don't know, probably by the time you have late types, you're at Chabrier. I mean, in the Milky Way, everything looks to be in this direction. Mm-hmm. But it still leaves a question. Okay. So adiabatic contractions out, it really didn't happen? Or is this another indication of we have a problem with understanding whether dark matter has a core or cusp? And basically, I don't think from this data you can tell the difference.
Like, so for adiabatic contraction, do we have any models that are tested on realistic form? I mean, it's very hard to form realistic disk galaxies in simulations. So how do we know what the adiabatic contractions from simulations would be predicted to be for the end product? And I know for...
So we know that in Allison simulations, she turns a nano W profile into core, right? No, so clearly adiabatic contraction there doesn't do anything. That's adiabatic expansion.
Well, not for Milky Way, though.
Not for the Milky Way.
Not but for you need it to be for Milky Way.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, it was a paper by Oleg, you know, basically commenting on the stuff that we had with Dutton, that, you know, the data tells us we need basically no adiabatic contraction, yeah. Saying, well, you know, all the simulations show adiabatic contraction, so...
But that's my question. That's all the simulations are for higher mass range, right?
So question,
this is for higher mass range.
How do you get this absence, for example? I mean, you know that there's a disk, right? You know that halo form. Halo. An adiabatic contraction is something that should have happened at some level. And then you can
tell... It depends on when you remove the barrier.
And how often. Just once is not enough, I think, for that.
No, it's the statement that
if you remove most of them, then you don't have adiabatic contraction.
Well, if you remove them adiabatically, which means that slower than the local dynamical time, which is actually very slow, very short, right? Halo will respond adiabatically as well.
So it goes back. And even stronger than that, if you contract it adiabatically and then you remove it instantaneously, it goes back to the initial output, unless you do that with more than about 10-20% of the total mass of the system. Okay, that was the original paper by Navarro and Frank, and where they show that you can get this core creation, but you needed to first adiabatically contract 20% of the baryons and then instantaneously remove 20% of the total mass. Okay, that's ridiculous. It's too much. So the mechanism of Pounson is cyclic thing, and they need to do this. It's a very different mechanism. It's a resonance mechanism. It's not an instantaneous removing of the mass.
So doesn't this go in the right direction then, of not having adiabatic contraction in these galaxies that have more?
I think at the moment the statement is, no simulations of a system as massive as a Milky Way exists that ends up with a halo that would fall in this regime.
Well, I mean, we just said that for dark galaxy you get the core, for Milky Way size you don't get the core anymore, but you do not necessarily get the cusp steeper than what you started with.
Well, you don't need the core, you just need halo to be uncontracted, so to be just like an NFW original.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So then...
The claim by Oleg in their paper, and I think you were a co-op on that, right? Well, we looked at this in simulations, and all simulations do contract, so the claim that adiabatic contraction doesn't happen.
How does a simulation, do they contract for Milky Way size? Yeah.
I mean, ultimately not.
The biggest mass.
We looked at, right, they don't produce 20% of baryons in the Milky Way halo. Yes. So I think that's a huge puzzle, I know, why 20%? And so you know, if those 80% were actually removed in cyclical events.
So that's why our simulations do much better on the telefish simulation. That's because we have realistic stellar fractions. But you can ask, do they expand? Or would be interesting to know.
No, I think it would be interesting to see, you know, parameterize in the same way. Look at this. I think it's an outstanding puzzle. But I'm just saying, I mean, I do think that, you know, modulo the data may be flawed. Or there may be some issue with the data, the telefish relation. But I mean, this issue with the zero point of telefish relation has been around for decades now. And I think if I would summarize it, I would summarize in this way. You know, it does not allow you for any reasonable IMF to allow any significant amount of eddy back contraction.
What's interesting is that if there is a really ellipticals have saltpeter, massive ellipticals, and late types have Chabrier, I mean, Chabrier is considerably more top heavy with respect to saltpeter. And so it means more supernovae.
More
supernovae, more OB stars, more feedback per stellar mass. Mm-hmm. So they could be more efficient. No?
It's very confusing, eh? But
yeah. No,
but if you go back to your stellar mass, then it should be around.
I mean, the Chabrier is the
Chabrier
triangle.
Turns over, so you have for a given stellar mass, you have fewer lower mass stars, so you compensate by high mass, right?
So Krupa and Chabrier is the same. This one doesn't stop.
If you extrapolate it to like 20, right, you see that Krupa will have many more supernovae, right, than 20 solar masses than saltpeter.
Uh-huh. That's the same total.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we tend to think about elliptical, so yeah, they had it burst, but then maybe they were supernovae. Unfortunately, other pieces of evidence, people really want starbursts with high ratios to have top heavy.
But there's also the issue of the 0.1 to 100, we didn't talk about that. That makes a huge difference now.
Yes.
What is the range of stellar mass? It's not just
what
that shape is, but the range makes an enormous.
I think, you know, another point, and clearly, you know, Scott's a commander, and that all the stellar population models, I mean, clearly, if someone like Charlie Conroy, who's one of the world's experts on stellar population models, his models apparently completely get, you know,
you're trying to model some obscure features, right? And obviously, Charlie is probably doing the best job he can, but it's just difficult, and maybe some things like you know, there are some
steps. No, but what I'm getting at is, you know, trying to use observables to really learn something like these IMFs. I mean, how are we going to make progress if we don't have stellar population models that we can, you know, how well, what do stellar population models do? And it's one of you brought it up, the remnants.
Mm-hmm.
It's still not clear to me how people deal with these star remnants, whether they properly account for it or not.
Yeah, well, it's all counted, but I mean, they're uncertainty, but they're counted in the models, the uncertainty is. For example, you need to incorporate stellar mass loss as well, right?
Yes.
And that's also results in remnants. So models include stellar mass loss. The flip side of stellar mass loss is remnants.
Yes.
And you can ask, you know, how well does it model? So, well, they're trying to use as many, and mostly it's actually empirical constraint that constrain the models. No.
But when people say this stellar population model gives this stellar mass light ratio, when you say this stellar mass, that includes the remnants, or it includes only the things between 0.1 and 100 things that are actually
streaming
of light, and people do both.
Well,
you have to be very careful.
It tells you everything. It tells you initial mass, it tells you the final mass. Yes. And it's just whatever convention was in Bellator, right? Mm-hmm. So what Bellator calls stellar mass, that's the question. Because stellar mass, just due to stellar mass loss, you know, it changes by 30-40% from initial to final.
It's not all the galaxy.
So the other thing is that I think you can do lots at the high mass. I don't think you don't constrain it very much because you don't see just stars now anymore, either in the light or in the remnants.
If you say
I want to have lots of supernova and high redshift, fine, no problem. We're not constraining this at all.
You can have saltpeter and then flood.
You can have almost anything you want, everything.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying what's left is not sensitive to what the slope was.
Exactly.
2,100 solar mass stars.
Well, in fact,
you have no constraint on that unless you look at abundances.
No, beyond one, no. Yeah, just in fact, the cluster metallicities and intercluster medium they want three times more supernova than standard IMF produces.
Per stellar mass.
Yeah, right. Plus, I don't know what happened to that argument, but you know, you have this strange-looking flat curve, which says bottom light.
Oh, that's an old...
It's Peter von Lockhart.
Yeah, that's all.
So, I mean, in 2008, Peter... And that's actually what started this study with Charlie Kohler, because Peter argued that to explain the mass-to-light, the zero-point evolution of Fabian-Jackson, I think, or mass-to-light evolution.
You needed to have
right? And then they went and looked for evidence for this and found the opposite. but what happened to the original argument? I mean, it's still there, right?
Yes.
They basically covered all the bases.
So Peter himself said, oh, I was wrong here. I must have been wrong there.
But why? But what's wrong? So what's wrong with the original?
I think because he thinks this is even more crazy and never gets more publicity.
So if you assume that the IMF really said Peter, so what happens now to that zero-point evolution? I mean, it's probably pretty crazy.
Well, I mean, they realized that this issue is there, right? That their IMF, their IMF, the only way they could reconcile, their claim is, well, it's maybe only valid for the central regions of these most massive elliptical galaxies. Their spectra went out a little bit further, and from talking to him, you know, they want to get spectra further out in these massive ellipticals, at say, you know, 1 or 2 effective radii, and they want to look at these guys, because they cannot have the same feature if their interpretation of this feature is something related to, you know, IMF being very non-top heavy. So they don't know. I mean, here it's just marginally okay with autodynamical constraints, and as Hank was saying,
One green mass.
I think
they already looked. I think the answer is still different than Chabrino. So I think they looked at large radii from all galaxies. I just think that their data essentially is not telling anything beyond Salpeter. I think it tells that Salpeter, that AMF is not Chabrino there. But
what I do not understand is if it is to do with off enhancement.
No, I'm just saying that.
The Salpeter IMF and off enhancement give you those features.
Well, I'm not saying it can be that strong. I'm saying, you know, you can get.
That's why I thought this was an interesting thing. They went to these globular clusters, but they don't have the same method.
What you would need is something to make the CN less strong and the sodium stronger. And I don't know how realistic that is and how much you need to really make the feature this strong. It's just a guess.
Do they say for the wing forward also or just the sodium one?
No, it's just, so the wing forward, I'm not sure.
Wing forward is tough to observe actually because it's near infrared, so it's further into, I think like a lot of instruments don't cover it.
And if you even compare the sodium feature to the wing forward, I mean, the wing forward, just doing chi by eye, appears to prefer something like Salpeter.
That's the thing, that's what was my point, that if you look at those, you do chi square by eye, you can see that they're not consistent with each other, right?
Yeah.
And I think there are reasons to suspect that sodium, there's something strange in sodium, because if you look at this paper that they prepared, that Leon and collaborators preparing, I mean, there they have a sodium line that you can't fit with any IMF. Like, you can make it -4 and still doesn't fit, right? So it tells you that there's something strange. Whereas there's no such objection about wing 4, but then wing 4 doesn't really favor anything steeper than Salpeter.
And the shape seems to be different than the fit. That's always.
I should say also that there are some measurements in clusters, in stellar masses of central galaxies in clusters, where you would also, different dynamics and strong lensing, where you would also, if it was something like -3, the slope, you would just violate the dynamical mass.
How much did your assumptions about the gas affect the results for the late type galaxies? Think about the gas distribution stuff that Andre was talking about the other day. What did you have to assume about how those gas masses were distributed?
So basically, here's the observation that, you know, the
the weight of the H1 is just with respect to the gas, with respect to the stars. So the gas is almost never really that important in this analysis over this mass range that we looked at.
The other stars.
That's just because you only go down to about 10 to the 9.5 because of the halo masses?
Yeah, you see some of the contribution of stars within this 2.2 disk.
Oh, there's a green line down
there. That's a green line, yeah.
Okay.
The point is that the stellar mass to virial mass has to be constant. So I think in the range that you're studying, it's actually quite constant because you're essentially studying the mass stellar mass range you're doing.
Yes, sorry.
In the very beginning, the argument that it should be constant. And we know
stellar mass, what should be constant?
Stellar mass.
No,
essentially
you're working around the peak of the stellar mass.
If the velocity ratio is the mass ratio.
Around the peak is flat, right? So we know that, for example, Talley-Fisher relation does steepen at stellar masses below some 10 to the 9. Mm-hmm. You know, it's baryonic Talley-Fisher that stays constant. Mm-hmm. Right? You know that mm-hmm. this dependence of stellar mass to virial mass, the fact that it's not constant, it seems to be reflected in Talley-Fisher relation. Mm-hmm. You see it, right? Yes. So.
And it goes in here, right? that's all in here. Right? It's all in that stuff.
Right, but you're sitting essentially close to the peak of that curve, where it is really flat.
Yes.
Right. Yes. So any curvature is hard to detect. Whereas your argument that, but we know that stellar mass to virial mass changes really applies to much lower masses. And there we do see that it's not.
If you look at any of these papers that we read with Aaron, and you look at the more detailed predictions for these Talley-Fisher relations, we always predict that sort of they have some curvature, they're very massive.
And at low mass as well. Right?
And at low, even further, they sort of, they trunk.
Right, outside of the 9, you're already in a regime where you're quite different from the Milky Way in terms of baryonic fraction.
More like N squared.
I mean, that's a.
Yeah.
Here's the data, right? This data down to 10 to the 9 looks okay, but here below that, it gets, you need to go to the baryonic.
You showed the stellar mass, virial mass from, I don't know, you know how to plot from a 1 is matching.
The point that we're in the red curve?
Well, but like LMC is the constant, it's kind of blue.
Right, that's
like
that. Yeah, but so, it's pretty flat. I mean, so if you look at the blue curve and extrapolate it to in the line, it's not that steep, right?
When you do this,
so it should be constant, right?
Well, it's not perfectly constant, but it's not that far from constant. I mean, it's just an argument that is used that we know that stellar mass to virial mass changes. It really applies to like very low masses and maybe high masses, but not around the peak.
Well, you see here, right? This is sort of where we expect the peak roughly to be. So it's right here in this regime where you sort of expect things to actually start to change.
And they do change.
And they do change.
And you see,
but we're not probing it here. So in this regime, this is.
So that's what I'm saying. That where you expect the stellar mass to virial mass to really steepen, we do see effect on the Talley-Fisher relation. We do see Talley-Fisher steepen.
Yes. So what?
I'm just saying that your argument is okay for that regime because you don't expect strong.
I was okay. I see.
You don't expect a strong stellar mass virial mass relation in this mass range.
So,
you're sitting on the peak at zero.
It's this thing also, right? So the actual relation is this black line of the total star mass. And that one actually has curvature there, but it's actually the late depths which are amazingly constant. So, I'm not sure I expect that. I'm just